KFAI-FM Minneapolis-St. Paul. Online and archived at kfai.org, the community's true voice.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
What's up? This is Toolman.
And this is Bear Witness.
And we are the Hallucination.
And you're listening to Native Roots Radio.
Welcome to Native Roots Radio presents I'm Awake, Best Of.
The Hallucination.
They are going to become more brutal.
Couldn't cut, penny cut, baby.
Because all the hippies were trying to be Indians anyway.
They're going to become more repressive because it's a matter of dollars and their illusionary concepts of power.
Hey, Victor.
We must live in balance with the earth.
And also with recent happenings at Wounded Knee.
I am awake.
Welcome to Native Roots Radio Presents. I'm Awake, and I'm your host, Wakunja Hade. Hey, Kadagi, to all my friends and relatives in four directions, you are listening to Native Roots Radio Presents. I'm Awake, and I'm your host, Robert Pilot. Hey, we discuss local, national, Native news and events. And as you know, Native issues are human issues, and human issues are Native issues. While I am so happy and pleased to have Nick Tilson, founder and CEO of Indian Collective, on the show today. Nick, thank you so much for coming on, and really, it's our pleasure to hear your story and what's going on. Thank you so much for coming on.
Absolutely, Robert. Thanks for having me on.
This is great. I would really love to kind of start from the history of Indian Collective, you being the founder, and then also a little bit about yourself for our listening audience that may not know you.
Yeah, so I'll do it in this order. You know, just a little bit about myself. My father's side of the family is from the Minneapolis Twin Cities area. My father is Mark Tilson. His father was Ken Tilson. Ken Tilson was a pretty prolific civil rights attorney, and then he ended up becoming one of the original attorneys of the American Indian Movement in Franklin Avenue area there. My mom is from Pine Ridge. And it's Oglala Lakota, and was part of the Oglala Civil Rights Organization, who invited the American Indian Movement to come to Pine Ridge in the 70s. And so my parents met at the occupation or siege at Wounded Knee in 1973. And pretty much my whole life had been spanning the Osheti Shalkoi, going back and forth between the Twin Cities, greater Twin Cities area and Pine Ridge and the Black Hills. And so born and bred in the Osheti Shalkoi, and sometimes on the east end of the Osheti Shalkoi, and sometimes on the west end. Raised up in the movement, I started organizing as a teenager, and then went on to found different organizations, and one of them being Indian Collective. Founded Indian Collective in 2018.
Yeah, I'm really so happy to have you on. And talk a little bit about what Indian Collective does, because you do a lot for the community and you're supporting so many things. And our relative Leonard Peltier supported him. And at the end of our show, for years and years, we've been on 10 years, Nick, since Standing Rock, we always said free Leonard Peltier at the end of the show.
And now he's home, you know.
So
Indian Collective, it grew out of two things. It grew out of the place-based work of regenerative community development and just transition work and cultural organizing that I was doing in my home community on Pine Ridge with the Thunder Valley Community Development Corporation. We started a Lakota language immersion school. We started sustainable housing. We started a regenerative community development project where we actually built a community from the ground up, but founded in culture. And as that project was becoming I always say it's a Indian famous, where Indian country knows about it, but nobody else.
Mm-hmm.
And as that project began to be lifted up, then tribal people and tribal nations and indigenous people throughout Turtle Island started reaching out to us and wanting to do something similar to what we were doing, but within the context of their own tribe, culture, and spirit of place. And so I started kind of in 2014, 15, 16, racking my head of like, how do we support more? It wasn't about doing what we were doing at Thunder Valley. It was like Thunder Valley was just an example of what indigenous self-determination looks like when it's invested into. The development that we were building at Thunder Valley, the water source of that development that we were building was the Missouri River, because there's one of the largest rural water pipeline projects in North America goes from the Missouri River to Pine Ridge. So our drinking water for the development that we were building at Thunder Valley came from the Missouri River. And so then when things started popping off in 2016, I had people, tribal leaders and grassroots and movement people say, hey, we need help up here in Standing Rock. And so Thunder Valley deployed to Standing Rock with our workforce development crew and our community development crew and started doing organizing up there and assisting the resistance in Standing Rock. And when we lost that fight, and watching like the environmental movement and the climate movement converge on the Osheti Shakoi, I was like, these things are winnable, but we need to build lasting indigenous-led movement infrastructure so that we can sustain and build power over time when win or lose battles. And that we had to do both the work of frontline resistance work while at the same time doing long-term systemic work around building regenerative and community development and new solutions. And so out of those two worlds colliding together and coming together, then we started Indian Collective. And so Indian Collective has always done both frontline organizing and activism work, along with long-term community wealth creation, community development projects, food sovereignty, these different types of things. And so we're an ecosystem organization, and so we do that through grant making, where we have a variety of different grant making programs that we give grants to tribes, we give grants to individuals through the community collective abundance program, we give grants to indigenous artists, community development projects. We have a lending arm that does loans for community development. We have a product called Land Back Loans to help people get land back, tribal enterprises, those types of things, and then our organizing policy and advocacy arm of the collective itself runs campaigns. That's where the Land Back campaign has been situated. That's where the Freelander Peltier campaign has been situated. And then we also have a social enterprise arm where we engage as community developers ourselves too, so that we're not just a funder or a lender or a community organizer. We also engage in community development projects. And we have a 70-acre development project in Rapid City, South Dakota, where the Osheti Shakoi Community Academy is located. So we do really place-based work and at the same time supporting the larger movement and larger narratives. And so that's the breadth of what we have done. And we're now in our eighth year as an organization right now.
My goodness. Wow. I had no idea. I knew a lot about some of that, but that's amazing. And you were doing work before Standing Rock, but I feel like Standing Rock was one of the things where the Seven Fire and the Eighth Fires went and really did a lot of things great for the Indian community. That's just an amazing story.
Yeah, Standing Rock was a pivotal point. I always said Standing Rock was one of these points where things would be measured from, and I always balanced like, Indian Collective. Standing Rock was also on an arc of 500 years of indigenous resistance, right? Mm-hmm. And it was the point in time in which many people in our generation, came together. It was our generation's wounded knee,
Yes.
It represented a focal point in which things had to change and things had to move and things had to evolve. And for me, I've been a community organizer since I was a teenager. Then I did cultural organizing on Pine Ridge, spiritual organizing and community development. And I always believed like that the work of building solutions things like starting emergent schools, things like starting community economic development projects, job creation. They don't have to be at odds with the resistance work to fight these corporations. In fact, it's better if they're actually done together, because then together it's systemic work for the land and for the people. And so that's why Indian Collective's, you know, infrastructure is about defend, develop, and decolonize, you know.
Wow. I am just like totally blown away. Hey, Nick, we got another segment. Do you mind holding on for another segment? Right on. Hey, we are with Nick Tilson, founder and CEO of Indian Collective, and you are listening to Native Roots Radio. We'll be right back after this short break. Please stay with us. Ho-wah.
Who teach us of our creation and our past, so we may preserve Mother Earth for ancestors yet to come. We are the land.
This is dedicated to our relatives before us, thousands of years ago, and to the 150 million who were exterminated across the Western Hemisphere in the first 400 years' time, starting in 1492.
To those who have kept their homelands, and to the nations extinct due to mass slaughter, slavery, deportation, and disease unknown to them, and to the ones who are subjected to the same treatment today, to the ones who survived the relocations and the ones who died along the way, to those who carried on traditions and lived strong among their people, to those who left their communities by force or by choice and through generations no longer know who they are.
To those who search and never find, to those that turn away the so-called non-accepted, to those that bring us together, and to those living outside keeping touch, the voice for many.
To those that make it back to live and fight the struggles of their people, to those that give up and those who do not care, to those who abuse themselves and others, and those who revive again, to those who are physically, mentally, or spiritually incapable by accident or by birth, to those who seek strength in our spirituality and ways of life, and those who exploit it, even our own. To those who fall for the lies and join the dividing lines that keep us fighting amongst each other.
To the outsiders who step in, good or bad, and those of us who don't know better. To the leaders and prisoners of war, politics, crime, race, and religion, innocent or guilty.
To the young, the old, the living, and the dead, to our brothers and sisters and all living things across Mother Earth, and her beauty we've destroyed and denied the honor that the Creator.
Hi, it's Dr. Evan Adams, and you're listening to Native Roots Radio. Hey, Victor, you better be listening.
Hey, welcome back to Native Roots Radio. We are here with our friend Nick Tilson, CEO and founder of Indian Collective. Nick, thanks so much for coming on again and telling us a little history about Indian Collective. I really appreciate that. Nick, let's talk a little bit about what's been going on lately. And I know there's been a Well, again, thank you so much, Nick, for coming on. I know you're really busy, and thanks again for coming on and talking and speaking your truth.
Absolutely. It's an honor to be on the show here. Thanks for the opportunity to be here.
Hey, let's talk. We talked about the history of Indian Collective. Let's talk about some of the stuff that's happened. And I remember a huge thing that happened July 4th, and I don't know how much you want to get into it, but I feel that I watched it live on Facebook Live, what was going on, and was really proud to see you taking land back during this crucial time in our history. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think we wanted to catalyze, you know, the land back movement. You know, if you go back to 2020, we were at a time when it was in the middle of COVID. It was after the murder of George Floyd and the ensuing, uprising that happened after that. and you started seeing, you know, statues begin to be toppled of colonizers, and Confederate flags begin to come down. And so strategically, like in our homelands out in Osheti Shakoi, we were like, hey, what could we do strategically to show our solidarity with the Black liberation movement while at the same time standing in our truth? And Mount Rushmore became like this symbol, right? That's not a statue that you can return back, or that you can topple. That is the only way to achieve justice in that situation is to give the land back. Mm-hmm. And so we used this strategic moment because Donald Trump was trying to, you know, come to the Osheti Shakoi and come to Mount Rushmore. And so we used that moment to catalyze the land back movement. And in the homelands of, you know, in the Black Hills is one of the longest legal battles over land in American history. And so those narratives came together. And so we used that opportunity to launch the land back narrative and the land back movement to catalyze it into the world so that it becomes into the ethos, and it holds a mirror up to the United States and creates a narrative and an opportunity for people to begin to give land back and also tackle and struggle with how is this country going to deal with its identity crisis as it relates to its own democracy and as it relates to its relationships and dealing with indigenous people. And so, you know, that protest and that blockade and that moment was as much about reigniting the fight for the Black Hills amongst the younger generation as it was also about holding a mirror up to America and standing in solidarity, being unapologetically indigenous while standing in solidarity with the Black liberation movement and uprising that was happening at that time in history.
Yeah, and it was totally amazing. And we talked a little bit about Standing Rock being our wounded knee. There's pictures of our relatives like Clyde Belcourt and the American Indian Movement there doing the exact same thing that you were doing. And so it's great. It's amazing. And a big peeny geeky for doing that.
Yeah, it's crazy how the shrine of democracy is actually, quote unquote, it's the shrine of hypocrisy, yeah. And it seems like that's a continued pattern, and that's why, you know, that place becomes a focal point, because the more that they have dug into that narrative of that place, the more it actually gives us the ability to organize around it and put it forward and say, actually, like, the truth is on our side, mm-hmm. You know. This place was carved by a member of the Ku Klux Klan on stolen land of indigenous people, and they call it the Shrine of Democracy. But I'm sure that's not the type of democracy that we're all fighting for.
Exactly. And one of the things, too, that I read years ago, and maybe you can educate us and me and my audience, is that was a sacred hill right there before they desecrated it with these presidents.
Yeah, you know, it was called the Six Grandfathers, mm-hmm. And people, we humblecha there, meaning that we had prayer camp there, and we went on vision quest in that area. We brought offerings there. It was a sacred place to us. It was a special place to us as Lakota people. And I know the Northern Cheyenne, Arapaho, other tribes, it was sacred to them too, and they also did ceremonies there. And so it's crazy that they literally targeted a sacred site called the Six Grandfathers in the Black Hills to then steal the land from us, violate their own constitution that they swore an oath to, and then destroy the land by carving the faces of these white men who were slave owners and molesters and colonizers of our people and of our land, and then host it as the Shrine of Democracy. It's pretty wild, you know?
Yeah, it is. Well, let's talk a little bit, if you don't mind, about the case, because, you know, that was 2020, and you've been dragged all the way to 2026 with this. Can you talk a little bit about the charges and then the process and then them finally being dropped?
Yeah, it's actually two different cases. So there was a case I was charged with, simple assault of a police officer. And I was charged with grand theft and burglary. And for quote unquote stealing a police shield and crossing out police and putting land back on it. And those, you know, it's like the irony of being, you know, charged with burglary and grand theft and simple assault. And those charges, you know, were in litigation from 2020 all the way to 2022. And those eventually resulted in those charges being dropped in 2022. And, you know, I did like 30 hours of community service, which ironically was just community patrolling in the community that I patrol in anyway, in Minnelusaha and Rapid City. And so nothing came of those. But in June of 2022, I was doing a community patrol unrelated to any of that. And I wasn't even a community patrol. I was going home after dropping my son off. And all I did was drive up in my truck to observe a police officer's interaction with an unsheltered relative. And that police officer, as soon as he knew it was me, he tried to say that I was trying to run him over. With my vehicle. And as a result of that, and I never touched him, I never tried to run him over, nothing like that. They surrounded my vehicle with about 8 police officers within minutes. I refused to get out of the car. That night, they let me go. And then a year later, in 2023, they charged me with aggravated assault of a police officer, which is a 25-year charge.
Oh, my God.
And in addition to an obstruction charge, and none of those charges, like none of those, like there was video of the entire interaction. So I was under indictment from 2023 all the way until this week, till this Monday. And we went to trial in January of this year, and we went to a full blown trial. A juror that was 95% all white in Rapid City. Mm. And that trial resulted in a hung jury, which then resulted in a mistrial because you have to have all 12 jurors agree to either convict or acquit. And then they gave the prosecution 45 days to then decide if they were going to retry the case. Oh. That deadline was Monday. And they chose not to retry the case. And so we beat that one. Between 2020, all the, I've been under indictment for 6 years. And if you realize, like, NDN's just now in its 8th year of operation, 6 of those 8 years I've been under indictments with bogus politically motivated charges. But with the help of the people, we beat every single one of those charges.
Yeah, it was really impressive to see all the aunties there and, you know, the support that you had. And I know on Indian Collective, the Facebook page, that you did a poster of thanking all of them.
Yeah, we had to. It was powerful. I was lucky enough to be raised by a lot of matriarchs and accountable to many matriarchs that I work with and aunties, and it was emotional to watch the grandmas and the aunties come out and support that the way that they did, and it made me feel strong and protected, and it also in a way it also like held the feet to the fire to the prosecutors for, like, you know, bringing these bogus charges in the first place. And they had to do what they did in front of the native community, in front of the grandmas and aunties, and so they were. It was the way for them to demonstrate their own power, which is incredible amount of power that they have.
Absolutely, Nick. Do you have time for another quick segment?
Yep.
Excellent. Hey, I am here with Nick Tilson, founder and CEO of Indian Collective, and what a great show this is. We're going to be right back. This is Native Roots Radio. Please stay with us. Ho-wah.
Programming on KFAI is supported by Quit Partner. Quitting smoking or vaping is easier said than done. Quit Partner offers Minnesotans no-cost resources to quit nicotine, including patches, gum and lozenges, coaching, and digital support. More at quitpartnermn.com.
This is Dallas Goldtooth, and you're listening to the Native Roots Radio. Hoka Hicha!
Welcome back to Native Roots Radio Presents. I'm Awake, and this is Robert Pilot.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. This is Robert Pilot. We are here with our friend Nick Tilson, who is, Superman in the Superman organization. He's the founder and CEO of Indian Collective. Nick, thanks so much for coming on. I know you're super busy, and it just really means the world to me to have you on. And I'd really like you to talk about what you want to talk about here in this last segment with us.
Yeah, thanks again, Robert. It's an honor to be on this show. I love community radio. You know, one of the things about my family lineage actually goes back to Native Radio. One of the demands in Wounded Knee during the siege or occupation in 1973 was the creation of a community-owned public radio station on the reservation that can hold the tribal council accountable. And because that whole struggle in the 70s was about the tribal council not being accountable to the people and committing violence on the people and misspending funds. And so one of the tangible things that actually came out of the occupation and siege at Wounded Knee in 73 that both my mom, Joanne Tall, and my father, Mark Tilson, worked on was the creation of Keeley Radio Station.
Yes.
And back then, in the early 80s, there was no community organizing unless you had a community radio station. And it was one of the first very owned and operated public radio stations in America, KILI, there in Porcupine, where I'm from. And I got to watch my parents and the community launch that radio station and be a part of that. And so I have a great deal of respect for you continuing on what you're doing here with Native Radio, but also for listeners and younger generation to realize that back in the early 80s, there was no indigenous organizing happening in Central and South America or anywhere on Turtle Island without radio. This was before the radio was the organizing tool for revolutionary work and revolutionary thought. And I think it's important that we stay true to that and use it as an organizing tool. So it's one of that inspiration is one of the things that inspired me and Indian Collective to launch a podcast and a show that we have, which we're at season four of, called Land Back for the People. And I wanted to, you know, invite folks to listen to that, because what we do on that show is we invite in different movement leaders. We use it as a way to talk about not only how Indigenous people are getting their land back, but as we get the land back, what are we doing? What are we doing with the land? We're building food systems. We're starting schools. Mm-hmm. We're doing economic development. We're meeting the needs of our people. We're stewarding land on Indigenous values and practices. I had a guest, you know, at the end of last year, who is organizing nuns within the Catholic Church to organize and politicize nuns in the land back framework, so that the Catholic Church can begin to give land back to Indigenous people. And it's so awesome to see the amount of organizing happening on multiple different levels throughout. And so we highlight those stories on Land Back for the People. And so hopefully we can continue to do some collaborative work with Native Roots Radio and talk about land back and uplift that podcast. And part of that is, you know, it's part of our narrative work. Another exciting thing that's happening at NDN Collective that I wanted to share, and this is a little bit of a preview, is that historically, when we first launched the Land Back campaign, we used the website landback.org. We created that website as a campaign tool to bring land back into the ethos. We're now turning landback.org into a storytelling platform.
Cool.
To tell the stories and examples of what's happening within the Land Back movement. So it'll instead of it being a campaign website like it was before, it actually will morph into a place that has blogs, people telling their stories. It's also going to be the home for the Land Back for the People podcast, short form videos, and it's going to be a way where people throughout the Land Back movement can be contributors to that too. They're going to contribute stories and pictures and photographs and tell and continue to narrate and tell the story of the Land Back movement, because it's live and it's a living, breathing, decentralized movement, you know?
Well, you can have your own network, and that's what it sounds like you're doing, and that's amazing. One of the things I'd really like you to let our listening audience and people watching us on YouTube and Facebook and X and Blue Sky and all the other platforms we're on, what platform can we hear your podcast in?
You can hear it on all the places that you can, you know, you can go, you can subscribe to the YouTube channel, NDN Collective and Land Back for the People on YouTube. You can hear it on pretty much every platform that exists out there. We have both a video version of it, and we also have, you know, just the audio version of it too. And so more subscribers helps us, you know, helps us get the story out there and what we're doing there. And it's really like the thing I like about it is we don't pretend to, like, I'm not a journalist, and like, we don't pretend to be journalists. We're just organizers and we're producing this podcast, like, in our adjacency to other organizers to uplift their stories and what tribes are doing and what people are doing to, you know, to catalyze the movement forward.
That's amazing. Kudos to you. And I'd really love to promote that, because that's in a small way what we're doing here in Native Roots Radio. I know one of the things, especially the attack in the Twin Cities, we've been really talking more political. But to bring the artists and the storytellers and things like that back to Native Roots Radio, now that ICE has settled down or gotten a little smarter, because there's still 700 ICE agents here in Minnesota.
Yeah, no, I think that this station and this show has been key to making sure to fight the misinformation game. Yeah. Because I think that, you know, they try to insert false and fake narratives even within our communities and with our movement. And I think with your radio show, Native Roots Radio, it's a place to be able to say, no, this is the truth. Here's people who are on the ground doing this stuff. Mm-hmm. This happened today. This happened in community. And I think that's been really key, you know. That's why I think I'm a big believer in this show and in shows like it, because I think that we have to, no matter in the world of all this technology and misinformation, we just need, as human beings, be able to talk with one another and build community with one another in multiple different forms, you know?
Wow, I could not say that any better. I'm just so happy to have you on. Can you talk a little bit? We got a couple minutes left in this last segment. It's gone so fast. Talk a little bit about our relative Leonard Peltier. I had the opportunity to interview him while he was in prison, which was unbelievable. And then also to see the work and him being let out with only minutes left in President Biden's term, and seeing you and your group welcoming back to free land, in a sense.
Yeah, I mean, we ran that campaign for multiple years on multiple facets. You know, we had high level lobbyists that were working for Indian Collective, working at the federal policy level. We also had grassroots organizers, building the groundswell and controlling the narrative and working directly with Leonard. You know, how we got that campaign was I had sat down with Leonard and I said, we will be accountable to you and only you, not any of these other people. But we will fight for you and we'll tell you the truth and we will use the movement infrastructure that we built at Indian Collective to fight for your freedom and for you to come home back to your homelands. And it was emotional and it was beautiful. You know, that was the very first organizing campaign at 15 years old that I was involved. It was the very first organizing I ever did. So at 43 years old or 42 years old then, you know, to be able to bring him home was powerful. And I wanted to, and we wanted to pay homage to those who have come before us, the leaders of the American Indian movement, the leaders of our people, to show that we can help do in complete unfinished business and bring Leonard Peltier home. And we were able to do that.
Amazing. And you said emotional. I couldn't believe how it hit me when it did, when it was official on the website. And of course, as soon as the orange one became president, it was taken off. So it's a little confusion, but I couldn't believe how emotional I was because it's such a, he was such a, and still is, a person that we all can relate to, because that could easily have been us put in prison for wrongfully, and especially in those days, but even now with what you went through.
Yeah, I always say, you know, I always say, and I testified this actually at Leonard Peltier's, you know, parole hearing in June of 2024. I testified that, or I guess it was June of 2025. That how Leonard Peltier was treated by the United States government is consistent of how in all indigenous people have been treated throughout history. You know, and that's why all of us see a little bit of ourselves in Leonard Peltier and his struggle. We relate to it. We're a part of it. We see it. Mm-hmm. And that's why his freedom means so much to us, is that, you know, we all deserve to be free. And that's why Leonard Peltier deserves to be free too. And so it meant so much to both free him, but also it was an acknowledgement that what they have done to Indian people and what they mm-hmm. have done to Leonard Peltier was wrong. It was mm-hmm. wrong for them to wrongly accuse him. He is innocent, and it's wrong for them to use the American legal and political system to go after an indigenous person. And you know, and I think that's why it means so much to all of us. You know, and he came from an era that fought for so many rights that we all benefit from today. You know.
You know, that was so well said. That's what I tried to say, but you said it so eloquently. I appreciate that. That's exactly why so many people, including myself, are so emotional. Nick, any can I get to a website, anybody that wants to donate or find out more about Indian Collective before we let you go?
Yeah, it's just slang, right? I mean, we created a whole nonprofit and movement infrastructure around Indian slang. It's just NDN Collective. .org, ndncollective.org. You can find out more about our organization. You can donate there. You can hear about what we're doing there. And then, of course, follow the podcast. Follow us on all the platforms at Indian Collective. And then our podcast, Land Back for the People. You can subscribe to that as well.
Well, a big Pinigigi, thank you so much for spending time with us. And let's do this again real soon. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Had to hit that right button there. Hey, welcome back, everyone. This is Native Roots Radio, and we are here with our friends Gayla Whitewater and Sunshine Thomas Bear, and we're talking about the great videos that they're putting out there. Do you want to give any kind of more update of the video that we're going to play?
Sorry, her mic was muted. Yes, so the video that you're about to play is a video about Lillian St. Cyr. So Lillian St. Cyr was a Ho-Chunk woman. She was the first Native actress. And that was during when they had the silent film era. So she was one of the first Native actresses in history. And she was from here in Winnebago. So the video is just about her life and the things she accomplished, the work that she did in her lifetime. Really inspiring woman.
That I've seen the video, and that's take a look, because you know I'm a little technology. Hopefully this will all work. Get your point your finger, cross your fingers in a good way, and that's that's play it right now. Ho-wa.
This Women's History Month, Hishgekji Hodak is honoring the strength, resilience, and legacy of Ho-Chunk women who shaped history. Every Friday in March, we're uplifting the stories of Hinuk whose lives continue to inspire our communities today. Today, we honor Lillian St. Cyr, also known as Princess Redwing, a Ho-Chunk woman who became a pioneer in early film and a lifelong advocate for our people. Lillian Margaret St. Cyr was born on February 14th of 1884 on the Winnebago Reservation in Nebraska. She was the daughter of Julie DeCora and Mitchell St. Cyr and came from a family deeply rooted in the arts and education. But her early life was marked by loss. By 1888, Lillian was orphaned, and like many Native children of that time, she was sent into Indian boarding schools. She spent nearly a decade there before enrolling at the Carlisle Indian Industrial School in 1894, where she eventually graduated in 1902. After school, Lillian entered a world where Native identity was often misunderstood, romanticized, and exploited. In 1906, she married James Young Johnson, who later became known as James Young Deer. Together, they performed in Wild West shows and theatrical productions during a time when non-Native audiences were fascinated by staged versions of Native life. They even performed in New York City's Hippodrome Theater alongside over 100 Lakota performers in a production called Pioneer Days, reenacting scenes like stagecoach battles and the ghost dance for mostly white audiences. But these performances opened another door. By 1908, Lillian began appearing in the early silent films. Possibly starting with The White Squaw, she quickly became recognized not just as an actress, but as someone who understood Native culture deeply and refused to let it be misrepresented. In 1909, Lillian and her husband were hired as technical consultants for a film, helping guide how Native people were portrayed on screen. And by 1912, her character Redwing had become so popular that other studios began copying it. Then, in 1914, Lillian made history. Performing as Princess Redwing, she became the first Native American actress to appear in a silent film, starring in The Squaw Man, the first Western filmed in Hollywood. But even in that moment, inequality was clear. Despite being a lead, she was paid far less than her male co-star. When told she should feel honored to work alongside a highly paid actor, Lillian responded, "What about him? He's working with a 100% American." Lillian wasn't just in front of the camera, she shaped what was behind it. Over her 15-year career appearing in more than 70 films, she worked as a writer, costume designer, prop maker, cultural consultant, and even performed her own stunts. She made her own regalia, she corrected inaccuracies, she made sure Native people were seen as human, not props. After her film career ended in 1925, Lillian didn't step away from her work, she shifted it. She moved to New York City, where she lived independently as an educator and a performer. She designed and sewed Native-inspired clothing for businesses like FAO Schwartz and created regalia for theatrical productions, tribal members, and organizations. But even more importantly, she became an advocate. Lillian helped establish the American Indian Community House, one of the first urban Native resource centers in the tri-state area. She worked with the Indian Unity Alliance, advocating for Native recognition and pushing for the creation of a National Indian Day. In 1929, she stood alongside around 200 Native people from different tribes in Prospect Park, Brooklyn, a powerful show of unity, visibility, and resistance. Throughout the 1930s, she continued to use her voice, her art, and her presence to uplift Native people and fight for recognition, dignity, and community. Lillian St. Cyr passed away on March 13th of 1974, but her legacy lives on. She was a Ho-Chunk woman who navigated spaces not built for her, challenged stereotypes, and used every role she had, on screen and off, to uplift Native people. Join us every Friday in March as Hishgekji Hodak continues honoring the powerful legacy of Ho-Chunk women, past and present. Wainigi Napwi. Thank you for watching.
Wow. That was beautiful. And as a Ho-Chunk myself, I'm a little emotional. Thank you so much, Big Peeny Geeky, you two. Wow, a lot of research involved in that 3-4 minute clip. Amazing work.
Yeah, I really have to give props to Gayla for all her hard work with that. I'm really kind of struggle with technology. I'm more of a, you know, reading and research, and I write a lot of the blogs on our website. So I'm more of the back piece person, and Gayla does a lot of the research and gets these videos looking amazing. So I just really appreciate Gayla for all of her work with this.
Yeah, it takes both of you, but yeah, this, the footage there, that must have took hours to find all that.
Yes, it took me, I think I worked on that for about 3 days. And it's a really short video, you know, but there, you wouldn't think that it would take that long. It's only like 4 minutes long, but yeah, a lot of research.
No, and it's beautifully spoken. Big kudos to you, Gayla, with the nice soothing voice with the flute in the background. It really is beautiful. That's all I can say. It's beautiful.
Thank you.
So you guys are going to have to talk amongst yourselves. I'm a little emotional right now, and it is a radio show, so you got to keep it going. Oh, yes. Wow.
So those videos, you know, it's March is Women's History Month, so those are posted every Friday. So we'll have another episode coming out on Friday if you wanted to talk about that one coming out.
Yes. Yeah, so our museum is named the Angel Decora Museum here in Winnebago. And so one of the women that we picked is Angel Decora, of course. And we were just talking while we were watching the video, talking about these women that were in these spaces at that time. You know, it was a much more difficult time dealing with probably men and how we were seen as a people back then. So what was I saying? So it was like,
not only like the racism and the prejudice.
Yeah, not only the racism, the prejudice and everything, but coming out from boarding schools to be able to advocate for our people and advocate for themselves, you know, as not only women, but, you know, Indigenous women. Mm-hmm. I think it's just something important to highlight. And I know we have very strong Hinooks, you know, throughout the country, you know, Ho-Chunk mm-hmm. women that go and use their voices. And that just is something to be extremely proud of. And, you know, we want to encourage that. So, you know, hopefully we'll be able to do that in the things that we do with his Hiskeshi Horak.
Well, 50 years from now, people are going to be doing videos about you two and all the great work that you're doing. I'm serious. That's beautiful. And, yeah, I'm still verklempt here a little bit, emotional about the great work that you're doing. And and it's so important for us as people to see this history and feel proud, too, because that isn't always the way, and that isn't always the way we feel, too.
Yes, and I think I kind of touched on that earlier, you know, just with all of the things that social media throws at us. You know, we get information so quickly about all kinds of cultures and all different things, you know, but our people need something to look at that is reflective of themselves, you know, so that they can build that pride in who they are. You know, our people, you know, over a dozen removals and sessions to mm-hmm. be where we are today. So it's important that we as people, Ho-Chunk women and men, look back at that and want to revitalize that and revitalize our language, our culture, and bring our voices back and be proud of who we are, you know, because they survived all of that for us to be here today.
Yes, and that's beautiful words. Again, we got less than a minute here in this segment, and I really, really appreciate you guys coming on, especially last minute. Our relative Arvina Martin is not feeling good today, so I really appreciate you guys coming on today. Any last words on how people can get a hold of you or get a hold of these videos where people can watch these?
Like Gayla said, you know, we're across all social media platforms, which is X, YouTube, TikTok, Facebook,
Instagram,
and we also have our own website, which is Hiskashi Hodak. And so look up any of those things and you can reach us through any of those if you know have questions. And we just want to continue to shed light on who we are as a people.
Again, Pini Gigi Wee to you two. Thank you so, so much for coming on and keep up the great work. And hopefully we'll see more of you on Native Roots Radio, but also look for these great videos and these little stories about strong Native people, the Ho-Chunk people, Winnebago of Nebraska. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We'll see you soon. Hey, we'll be right back. This is Native Roots Radio.
Support for KFAI comes from the Parkway Theater and Lounge, presenting Favorite Girl, Friday, April 10th. Celebrating their highly anticipated debut album, Favorite Girl blends harmony, rock, and a dash of brass. Led by British songwriter Katie Vernon, who has been performing original melodic folk pop for over 25 years in the Twin Cities and in the United Kingdom. Opening the night are sets by Sarah Morris and Sally Ford. More information about Favorite Girl at the Parkway is available at theparkwaytheater.com. Programming on KFAI is supported by Quit Partner. Quitting smoking or vaping is easier said than done. Quit Partner offers Minnesotans no-cost resources to quit nicotine, including patches, gum and lozenges, coaching, and digital support. More at quitpartnermn.com.
Hi, it's Dr. Evan Adams, and you're listening to Native Roots Radio. Hey, Victor, you better be listening.
In this portion of the show, we'd like to bring awareness to our wolf and bear populations throughout Turtle Island. Say no to the hunts.
Oh! Oh. Oh.
Hey, welcome back, everyone.
You always laugh at that part.
Welcome
That's
back.
It was supposed to be the bear.
It was the bear. Yogi Bear.
Yeah.
I want to introduce my awesome, beautiful wife, Wendy. She's been an animal advocate for many years, and she talks about our sacred animals and gives us sacred animal updates. How can you not give us sacred animal updates with this beautiful weather here in Minnesota?
I know. Hey, everybody. My name is Hanaji Hihani. That means cares to them, and I was given that name by my Dega Curtis. Curtis goes by Mashke Hanajinga, which means walks on white clouds. I'm a policy volunteer for Humane World for Animals, and I work on animal issues at the local and state level. It's always my pleasure to do that. And yes, it is beautiful. Excuse me. Got a little froggy in my throat. So Wanda and I went for a walk. I was just and as I'm walking, there's a lot of people out right now because it's so beautiful out. It's almost 60 degrees and it's just really nice. It feels like, you know, we're coming alive again after this long winter.
Oh, I know it snowed in May before, so hold on.
Oh, my gosh,
I know.
I'm not going to get too excited about this. But as I'm walking, right, I'm walking Wanda, and there's people out walking their dogs. Half of the people have their heads down into their phones while they're walking their dogs.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's kind of like... I don't know. I think it's like a safety issue. Like Wanda and I were walking down the sidewalk and this guy has his head down in his phone and his big dog are walking towards us. And I can't cross the street because there's other dogs over there. And it's just like I'm walking towards this guy and I'm like, is he going to put his head up? Is he going to get his head out of his phone? Is he going to notice I'm here? Am I going to walk by and his dog's going to attack Wanda? Like all these things are running through my head. So finally I'm like, hello, excuse me, hello. And he finally like, oh, I'm like, can we pass? And then finally he like, you know, makes sure that is, you know, he's holding the leash a little bit, you know, tighter. He's pulling his dog over to the side a little bit so that Wanda and I can just like pass by.
Jeez.
Well, I'm just like, seriously, I really think it's like a safety issue. I mean, Robert, you remember that time you were walking Wanda down the alley and that dog came, you know, out of nowhere and ran after you guys. Like if you had your head down in your phone or, You know, you aren't going to see that.
That was a lickety split kind of thing, pulling her up by her harness and just protecting her because that dog wanted to bite her.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, if you had your, you know, you concentrating on your phone, you know, a split second, that could happen. That was dangerous. Didn't you tell me afterwards, like, Wanda felt like Wanda was like...
She was looking up at me, like barking at me,
she was
thanking
appreciated you saving her from the other dog. I mean, that could happen anytime, you know? Mm. And then, like, people, like, hold their leash, you know, the leash at the end. I've talked about this before. They have a loop at the end of the leash and just hold it with your hand. You're supposed to put your hand through it.
Well, what about those people with the gun kind of thing that can go 50 feet?
The retractable leashes, save your little dog's drives me. Those are very, very dangerous.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you're coming to an intersection, right? And you're walking your dog with one of those expandable, I don't even remember what they're called, expandable leashes. Yeah. You know, you hold them like you said. It's like a gun. And you press the button and you let the dog go. And
You think you're doing them a favor.
No, it's
but
dangerous.
Urban dogs.
Those are dangerous.
They're all over the place.
I know. And, you know, if you put your hand through the leash, through that hoop, and you have your arm around it, if the dog pulls, the leash has nowhere to go because it's, you know, pulling against your wrist. It's hard for me to explain it.
No,
but anyway, come on, people.
No more phones.
Let's pay attention while we're walking our dogs. Anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, there's lots of dogs. And every day, like on Facebook, you know, it's like people are bringing their dogs to the dog parks.
Yeah.
And there's always like, your dog bit mine. And this happened. I mean, first of all, Wanda is not a dog friendly dog, but I don't know if I would bring my dog to a dog park. Anyway, I found this little thing. It's really interesting. It's from Animal Matters Facebook page. And they are, they're from Best Friends. It's an animal sanctuary. It's in New York City. Remember we found Best Friends?
You and Joanne?
No, you and I. Remember when we were just walking that? Remember that?
That was just out of the nowhere.
Quite a few years ago. We were just like walking around Manhattan.
Little Italy.
Yeah, and we just found this animal sanctuary in the middle of, it's a shelter.
Yeah.
And we like walked in to like check it out. And they're like a really good group. They're called Best Friends. So anyway, I follow them, of course, on Facebook. But they posted this statistic, which I found really astonishing. If just 6% more people chose to adopt versus purchase their pets, we would end the killing of dogs and cats in the nation's shelters. So just 6% of the population.
We need to amplify that.
Yeah, only 6% more. But you know, as many, like I've had our neighbors, like, Wendy, what do you think about, you know, we want to get a dog and we want to get a breed, you know, this particular breed. What do you think we should do? And I give them this long, non-judgmental, serious, like, what's happening with the animal world today and how many dogs get euthanized and how many great dogs are in foster care right now or in shelters or whatever. And, you know, giving them this big explanation and why you should shop, you know, adopt, do not shop, and why it's important, blah, blah, blah. They turn around and they go to a breeder.
Yeah.
Like, why did you ask?
Hey, there's something I want to ask you, too, because you put this out there, and maybe we can run a spot on Native Roots Radio, but... Mm-hmm. Talking about your art and how you're selling cards. You're selling cards, and then the proceeds are going because a lot of our relatives with issues with ice and all that have had to give up their dogs.
Yes, yes. So I have a Facebook page. It's called Pilots Palette. It's on Facebook, or, you know, I don't know. Yeah, Pilots Palette with an apostrophe. Pilots with a pasta and palettes, P-A-L-E-T-T-E.
Ooh.
It's not the mouth palette. It's the painting palette. Yeah. So I know it's confusing.
I know.
Anyway, I'm selling my art. It's right now I have just my greeting cards for sale. A lot of different stuff, a lot of animals. I paint a lot of animals, mm-hmm. but I've done some Native American art. Yeah. I've done just some scenery. I've done sunflowers, and all the proceeds are going towards animal shelters that have pets there because they were surrendered because their people have been deported, and or groceries for people, and or, you know, getting their laundry done, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, check out Pilot's Palette. And I'll update my page later with some more stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just, you could just message me via Facebook and I mail them out.
Fresh Air Community Radio is KFAI FM Minneapolis St. Paul. Online and archived at kfai.org. The community's true voice.
In recognition of the freedom